Yeah, we're going to do in chapter 11, verse 29, Pasuk Chav Tes. We'll start with we're going to finish this very cryptic prediction about a king from the north and a king from the south, and fit it into the historical framework. And then, when all that is finished, we're going to look at Megillat Chashmonaim and see how it fits. Okay? It continues to be a little difficult, but let's see what we left off was where the king from the north, by this time we were up to Antiochus IV, set his sights against the Bris Kodesh, against those who had the Holy Covenant, right? And we'll see that you said last time is that referred to the Kohanim, that the battle against Antiochus would be waged by those who are in the Bris Kodesh. And that would be Kohan. Okay. Right. And it also referred to a Negid Bris, those who were in the leadership of the covenant. Right. And that would be the Kohanim who led the revolt against this king. If you recall, last time I mentioned also of Sadigon, who said that there's even a hint to that, where Moshe blesses the army of the Levim, Baruch Hashem Chelo, that they should wipe out the trunk of this figure, and the trunk in the Nebuchadnezzar's dream was Yavan, was Greece. Okay. Here we're talking about the king from the north who will set his sights on Egypt and will not succeed. Certainly not the way he was hoping. Okay. All right. So Lamoed Yashuv Uva Benegev Velo Tiye Karishona Vecha Acharona. Right. Okay. So this is what happened. The king from the north returned to Egypt. He went to Egypt to fight, but he was not successful. Right? And then he will return to try to be successful again, to conquer Alexandria. Josephus describes this battle, where Antiochus IV tried to destroy Jerusalem, destroy Alexandria in 168 BCE, which is 3 years before the Maccabean Revolt. Right? He tried to conquer Alexandria. Josephus describes this battle that the Romans joined in. The Romans did not want Antiochus to be successful in Egypt because he did not want them to have a foothold in the south. Right? So the Romans joined into this battle to prevent him from being successful, and they achieved that objective. Okay. Okay, so Lamoed Yashuv Uva Benegev. Lamoed means another time later, usually a year, like the angel told Sarah, Lamoed Ashuv Ka'ez Chaya. Right, so Lamoed Ka'ez means another time, like now. Right, so here it just says Lamoed, another time later, he will return to the Negev, to the south, Velo Tihiyeh. He will not succeed. There will be differences. The first battle, he was actually quite successful in Egypt, and he was gloriously accepted in Egypt. The second battle, he caused so much havoc, and he lost so many men on his side, so many men on the Egyptian side, that not only was he lambasted by the Egyptians, but his own people were upset that he caused so many losses in a battle which was foolishly fought. The fact is, he would have been successful and he would have conquered Egypt if not for the entry of the Romans. The thing is, though, that a seasoned military strategist can't just say, well, my forces can defeat the Egyptian forces. He has to always factor in every possible variable of what's going to happen with this battle. He should have factored in that the Romans would not want him to have be up north near them and have such a stronghold in the south. So he should have anticipated that they would join in his All this is, can be found in Josephus, and his second battle was unsuccessful, and he lost all his glory. This may explain his obsession at this point, just this is just where he started to enact laws against the Jews in Jerusalem that caused the Hanukkah story to happen.
Why was he so antagonistic against the Jews?
So there were some natural differences between the Greeks and the Jews that could explain this. For one, the Greeks were certainly closer to the Jewish love of wisdom and education than other nations before.
Yes.
But the Greeks also worshipped the body and the
yes.
beauty. And
yes.
So they say from Athens to Jerusalem, if you're sure you've heard that terminology, is it possible to have the beauty of Athens with the in the tents of Jerusalem? So the fact is, it's a Maamar Chazal. It should be Yafuso shel Yefet, Ba'ahalo shel Shem. Yavon, Greece, is actually the name of a child of one of Noach's children, Yafet. Shem, Cham, and Yafet. So Cham went to south in Africa, Shem stayed in the Middle East, and Yafet went all the way up north to the European area. So Yafet means beauty in Hebrew. Yafuto shel Yefet, Ba'ahalo shel Shem. Have you ever heard of that terminology? It's a Gemara in Megillah. Should be the beauty of Yefet in the tents of Shem. So Shem meaning Semites, Semitic, not Shame in English. Shem means one of Noah's sons named Shem. So I think that the one you could tell from the one mitzvah that the Greeks were obsessive about was circumcision. They thought that circumcision defaces the body, it defiles the body, and the beauty of the body is being affected, and we don't like that, and we want to worship the body. So Judaism thought that the body is something that is to be hidden, and to be, you know, it's nearest. You know, they loved priests. The way they competed in the gymnasium and the Olympics, and it was a shanda, yeah, for us, yes.
Were there Greeks who were fat?
I don't know.
Because if they would have engaged in gluttony, then they could have also said they're defiling their body by doing that.
Right, it's possible. In ancient times, being fat was equated with being healthy. You know? But
certainly,
yeah. So,
how long a period since Alexander's death did this take place?
About 130 years, maybe a little more, 140 years.
Not for three or four generations.
Yeah, 130 years is probably pretty safe. And Alexander died very young, you know, his 30s. Okay, so this pasuk may be referring to what Josephus writes. Josephus was probably aware of the text of Daniel, I'm sure he was. Whether he saw this as such a function of that, I'm not sure. But the Antiochus will not be successful in this new battle. And it says, Ubo vote see him. Now this, what we're about to read, is uncanny in its representation historically. Now what are tsiyim? Ships. Tsiyim. We have it in the Torah. Tsim.
Kitim.
There's a ship line. Zim. You ever see it? Z-I-M. They took it from this. Okay. So, Kitim are islands. Some say it's the islands of Crete. Okay. What's interesting is that when these words do appear in the Torah, the Targum to the words are Rome and Greece. Yeah. Rome is a Targum. Yonasan ben Uziel in the Pasukim, when Babylon mentions this, he calls it Romi.
Which one
is what? He said, no, Kitim is Rome, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Siam
is ship. No, Siam are ships. Kitim is probably Crete. Because a lot of prophets make reference to it. And they say to turn east to Kedar or west to Crete.
Mm-hmm.
And those are islands in the Mediterranean, not far from Israel. Okay. Now what happened was, an armada of ships were sent by Rome to prevent Antiochus' success. They did not want a strong Persia. Right? So that's what this is. Vobotsiim kitim, ships from Crete. Right? V'nich'o, meaning nich'o means lo yatzliach, they will not succeed. V'shov v'zo'am al bris kodesh. And he will return back to his place and be very angry on the bris kodesh. So you ask, what was his obsession against the Jews? So the text here does not reveal it, but if I were to make up something, right, I would say it's possible that he saw that the Jews helped the Romans defeat him. Right? Now, would the Jews join the Romans? You know, Antiochus IV was such a wicked king, right? So the enemy of my enemy is my friend. You know, they'll help his enemy. Right? Okay, and such an opinion does appear in a drash that Bnei Yisrael were helped the enemy defeat this Antiochus in this battle. So he took his anger out on the Jews. So the anger was manifest in preventing them from performing some of their essential mitzvahs. Of course, many Jews gave in. Many Jews were all too happy to give in. The Hellenists, right? At the same time, however, this caused a revolt against some other Jews, from the point of some other Jews. So it says, V'shov v'za'am al bris kodesh v'osa. And he did what he did. V'shov v'yavein alos v'bris kodesh. What this pasuk is talking about. You see, this when his decrees actually appealed to some of the Ozvei bris kodesh. They went along with it. Right? Would you believe that 17% of Jews in Germany in 1933... voted for Hitler? I don't know where they came up with that number, maybe from exit polls or something, but that's the number I've heard. There were a small percentage of Jews in Germany who thought that Hitler was only going to fulfill his rantings against the kike Jews who, you know, take off on Shabbos and want to keep the holidays and they don't eat bread on Passover, and, you know, those Jews who have to leave early on Friday, you know, those Jews, they'll get even with those Jews. We don't like those Jews. Mm. Right? So, okay, so that's the Ozvei Bris Kodesh. There were people all too happy. It's funny, I read this on Hanukkah this past year in Shul. It's a great, great line. This kid, his father is a secular Jew in Israel. This kid is asking him about the Hanukkah story that he learned about in public school. So he says that, you know, what were they fighting for? So he said they were fighting for religious freedom. So he says, Daddy, did the Maccabees keep Shabbos? So he said, well, I guess, maybe they kept Shabbos, that they were looking. You know, because the story is that they didn't let them keep Shabbos, they didn't let them do Bris Mila, they didn't let them do the holidays, or right? So certain things they just prohibited. And he goes one after the other. Did Maccabees keep kosher? He goes, nah, they didn't keep kosher. He goes, well, they were interested in clearing out the temple. Didn't they only serve kosher food in the temple? So he said, so one by one the kid is asking his father, and one by one the father keeps admitting, yeah, they must have kept Shabbos, they must have kept kosher. So then the son, his little boy, thinking out loud, he goes, Daddy, if we were alive at that time, would we have been on the side of the Maccabees or the side of the Greeks? you know, the fact is that people misunderstand what Hanukkah was all about. You know, it was about, you know, there were many Hellenist Jews who were all too happy with what Antiochus was doing. You have to deal with those, you know, Shehi Pehi Jews, you know. Mara calls them Shehi Pehi. Shabbos Hayom, Pesach Hayom. Shabbos, I have to work, leave work early. It's Pesach, I have to take off.
I never heard that expression.
It's a Gemara. Who do you think coined the expression according to the Gemara? Who in the whole Bible would coin? Haman. When he told Achashverosh why I want to get rid of them, he goes, "Wouldn't my kingdom lose if I got rid of them? He goes, nah, they're always going around the streets singing Shei Pei. And Rashi says, Shabbos Hayom Pesach Hayom. Okay, you know what? The Gentiles will be correct in so saying if we are always taking off. And in fact, it's interesting. There's a Rashi that says that Jews shouldn't do work on Chol Moed. Because if the Goyim see you doing work on Chol Moed, they'll say, was it work on Yom Tov too? And you're going to start to explain to them the differences between Chol Moed and Yom Tov. So, my father used to always tell us, worked in a hospital.
Okay.
Said, if you want these 3-day yontifs and these Monday, Tuesday, and then the next Monday, Tuesday, Shmini Atzeres and Sukkot and Rosh Hashanah, and so you have to be ready to work on their holidays. You know, take absolutely every year. Take December 25th, we do like two, sometimes three out of four shifts. One, two shifts, one off, and then another shift right away. Or with Thanksgiving every year, it's January 1st, be the first to take those shifts. Forget about the fact that they pay you a time and a half, right? But why do you get to take off on your holiday and their holiday? Because their holiday, the city gives you off. They're mandated to give you off. The hospital is closed on them, you know, whatever. Most of the workers are not in on that. It's like a Sunday. But nonetheless, someone's got to hold, because someone's got to hold on to the fort. So, it should be you. Let them see that there's some reciprocation. But if it's not, then of course they'll say that. They have the right to say Shei Pei about you. Right? Okay. Which anyone would do when someone is getting preferential treatment. In any circumstance. Not just kids or students. Anyone would do it. Okay. Uzroim Mimenu Ya'amodu. Zroim Mimenu Ya'amodu. There'll be much Zroa. Zroim is a more a terminology in the Talmud. Bali Zroa. What's a Bali Zroa? Strong men. In other words, they'll show their strength again on the Jews. V'chilalu ha-mikdosh ha-ma'oz. This is very clear. And they will defile the temple. How did they do that? Remember what they did in the story? They brought pigs into the temple. Right? Keep on clear. They defiled the temple. By now, it's hard not to explain these psukim in light of the Hanukkah story. Like you can see, Hakaman, you're stretching all this. But you know, it's really this king will mechal with his strong arm, and he will mechal the mekdash. Remember what you just said? From this pasuk, you probably know it. Okay? And they will stop the carbon tamid from happening. That's exactly what it says in Megillas Cheshmonim. They stop the daily sacrifice. And they'll make a shikutz. They'll make a despicable thing on the Mizbeach. Now, I want you to, if you can circle this pasuk in your minds, this verse we'll return to in order to predict the date of the arrival of Mashiach. Huh? Yes, this pasuk. This is the pasuk that will. I mean, you can cheat if you want and look into the last pasuk in the Sefer. It uses a similar little expression. No, I should say. If you look, go just turn a page or two to chapter 12, verse 11. Yeah. Wait a certain amount of years from then, and then that's when it will happen. Okay. Umarshie bris yachnif b'chalakos. There will be some rishayim who will be mefer the bris. Okay. Rishoim mafirim misabris, yachnif b'chalakos. Chalakos means like deceit or flattery. That's yachnof. Va'am yodei alohav yachziku v'aso. However, even still, there will be some amongst them who will be the yodei alokim, and they'll hold on to the bris. Those are the chashmonayim. Those are the kohanim. Okay. right? Now, what's this about Mashiach Bris? Believe it or not, it was very common amongst the secular Jews, the Hellenist Jews. You ever hear this is why the Mishnah says, HaMefer Briso Shel Avraham Avinu Ein Lo Chelek Olam Haba. What they did was that the men,
as the Greeks did,
they were so ashamed of the fact that
they had operations to,
recover, which is profoundly painful. There's an English word, it's called epiplasm. It's profoundly painful. It's mutilating. And so much they despised the fact that they were different, that they wanted to compete. They used to compete naked in the gyms,
in the
games. So they were so ashamed of the fact that they looked Jewish, and they so much wanted to be Greek that they would marshiyeh habrit. But they keep the word bris. Now bris can mean you know a general covenant, but the story of Hanukkah in Megillat Yeshayahu. When I finish this chapter, I'm going to get an English translation of this, and we will we'll see that it's all in there. All right, the bris was the one thing that the Greeks came after, and that was you know, you have to know when if you're going to oppress a people, you have to know which one to pick on. That's maybe all right. Let's knock them down where it hurts. But this is the one that they're just not going to stand for. Right? History shows that if a nation wants to end its Jewish population, just be good to them. They'll assimilate before you know it. And their grandchildren won't be Jewish anymore. Okay, anyway, so here, there will still be Am Yodei Elokav that will be Yachziku Vasu. They will still be, they'll hold on to the person. They will also do. They will not just secretly hold and quietly hold on to God's covenant. They will also, they will do something about it. Okay? Umaskilei Am Yavinu L'Rabim. A fascinating thing. You know, there was a movement called the Maskilim. Remember? The Enlightenment, the
recent times. Yeah,
yeah, yeah, the 1850s in Germany. Yeah. So, there is a movement of Maskilim and Divrei Hayamim, but they're only made up of Shevet Levi. Because they have the Seichel to know God. So, it's once again another proof from our text that this battle fought against this Greek onslaught will be Shevet Levi. Now, what went wrong? Why did the Hanukkah story is such a nice story. We say Hallel, we light candles. And within 30, 40, 50 years, it had turned so bad. The Hashmonai kings became really evil. They appealed to Romans for help, but and then the Romans stepped in, and then for then on, we basically lost our independence. And Herod was among them at the end. You know, some of these guys were really very bad. You know, Yanai and it was an interesting start. But the reason why, you know, hashkafically we say that it wasn't a success is because the Levim are the Kohanim of Shevet Levi. They're not supposed to be rulers. Rulers are supposed to be from Shevet Yehuda. The rulers are supposed to be descended from King David, not from the Levites. So it was. I wouldn't say it's roguish from the start, but it didn't continue well. It didn't have the blessings of didn't have godly blessings to it. But for right now, it says the Maskilim.
Those are the chances you take when positions are inherited.
Yes, quite so. Someone who is the son of the king, you see, Matisyahu, who led this revolt originally, and amazingly against all odds, was able to fight this new kind of warfare called guerrilla warfare, where the conventional arms just didn't cut it, and he fought against the elephants and all the other strategies of the Persians and the Greeks. And he defeated them. So of course it made sense that they would ask him to be king. So if your father is king, you're not going to give it up so quickly because you're from Shevet Levi. You know, Jewish history records Matisyahu well. His five sons, and Elazar, right? Shimon and Yehuda Maccabee and all those guys. But shortly afterwards, it went south. Okay. V'nichshelu b'cherev u'v'lehava b'shvi u'b'bizo yamim. This is what led to the Hanukkah story. In both the first and as well as the second book of Maccabees. Right, there will be a huge stumbling block for these people. Uvehi koshlom ye ozru ezer ma'at. In the midst of this michshol, in the midst of all of this, which lasted apparently from Josephus's writings 3 years, because it was 3 years from the time he unsuccessfully had to return in disgrace from Egypt till the time that the Chanukah story starts, 165 BC. So there would be great michshol for the Jews during this time. Pigs are being offered on the altar, and the Jews are turned against each other. So, in the midst of that mechshol, there will be ezer ma'at. God will give a small little nudge. Won't be a big like a Purim one shot, and your queen, you're in there, and it's going to be a small little nudge. And what's interesting is that you're going to have to see if there's any hint to a menorah or a Hanukkah story involving a miracle of oil. Because all I see is battle after battle. But don't be too concerned. There is another Navi who speaks significantly about the miracle of the oil. About a never-ending supply of oil because there are so many tubes leading into the menorah. Do you remember? It's the Haftorah of Hanukkah, Shabbos Hanukkah. We learned it a few years ago. Zechariah. Rani v'Simchi. The Haftorah of also Parshas Balozcha, we read about the menorah. So if you're concerned, that why isn't Neil talking about the miracle of the oil? Why is he talking about the battle? All right. Al-Anisim only talks about the battle, and the Gemara and Shabbos only talks about the oil. So every source, takes it from their standpoint. Incidentally, Zechariah, while he's certainly the main focus of his prophecy of this era is about the menorah, does mention, however, this pasuk, lo b'chayav lo b'koach im b'ruchinu Hashem. Sounds like a battle. You will not win this battle b'chayav lo koach, with strength and might, but with the word of God. Okay. So in this time of falling, of stumbling, there will be a small help from above. V'nilvu aleihem rabim b'chalak lakos. This is a difficult part of the pasuk. Okay, so we'll have to see what is in Megillas Chashmonaim that can refer to this. He said many people will join them, v'nilvu aleihem, right? Maybe a hint to the word Levi there. Rabim b'chalak lakos. Many will join with them. We'll join the Chashmonaim. How's that at 4:30 today? Many people will join the Chashmonaim, b'chalak lakos, but some will do it with deceit. Why? Because there were lots of misyadivnim there amongst the Jews, who were sort of on the fence. Why were they on the fence? Because they weren't sure. But imagine this, let's say you're a very secular Jew today. What's your agenda? I want abortion. I want homosexual marriage. I want a force that is open to all those things, but antithetical to the rest of Judaism. So I say, well, I am Jewish, but those things are so important to me. I'm listening sometimes to talk shows, and I see people call in because this Jewish woman is calling in from Midwest. She said, well, why did she vote for Obama? Because for me, it was all about same-sex marriage. He was for same-sex marriage, that did it for me. Nothing about Israel, the economy, at least the environment, that's what did it for her. So there are many Jews who misyavnim, that we call that, you know, they loved Greece, they loved the Greek way. I mean, there is a terminology in the Purim story. Rabbim Ameha Oretz Misyahadim.
Mm-hmm.
The opposite of Misyahadim. Misyahadim. They'll want to become Jewish. Okay. Umin Hamaskilim Yikoshlu Litzrof Bahem Ulavarer Ulabain Ades Kates Ki Od Lamoid. Right? The maskilim will stumble themselves. Okay, the maskilim will stumble because they want to accept them in the interest of unity. These are Jews, after all. I mean, look at what they'd say today if someone said, "No, you're not Jewish," right? So, in the interest of unity, we would like to join them, but they will make a mechshol because they'll be. They won't discern well enough over who is good to have in this unity government or this unity gathering, and who is not worthy. I'd like to use another example. When Nehemiah built the Beis Hamikdash with Ezra, built the second temple. So it says that there were some Jews from Shomron, originally from the north, who at first scattered, some returned, who wanted to take part in the building. And Nehemiah said, "No, you can't. I'm not going to let you. You feel Jewish, but you're not behaving Jewish. And we don't want someone having a role to play in the building who does not keep the authentic Judaism, let's put it that way." I mean, it's a debate that rages all the time. We're putting up a new mikveh for the neighborhood, and there's a conservative shul, and the conservative, they sometimes use the mikveh too, and, you know, get married. So they want to have a say in it. They want to donate money. Okay. You can't have a say in how to put up a mikveh. I'm sorry. What kind of say do you want to have? The temperature of the water? Okay, we can do that. You want to put up the... have a daily bouquet of flowers, you want to design the wall, you can do all of that. But don't chime in about how the mikveh should be built. No more than that I should sit on a board that meets once every 6 months about the most updated way to do brain surgery. Right? I don't feel I deserve to be on such a place. As much as I think that brain surgery is an important thing. So too, I don't think that Jews who are not observant deserve to be have a say in how a mikveh should be built. Right. Okay, so should we second guess Nehemiah? Maybe he was wrong in objecting to the Shomronim taking part. Right. This, by the way, is the Das Mikra's explanation of that test that Haggai gives in his book. He asks the people about the meat that was wrapped in a garment. It was holy meat, but couldn't transfer the holiness. If holy meat from a sacrifice touches other meat, that other meat becomes holy. And you have to apply all the restrictions of sacrificial meat to that other meat that it touched. Even though it's just a hamburger. Oh, and you can only eat it for one day. You can only eat it in a certain area. You can, I mean, like this week's parasha talks. Right? So, and next week's parasha. So, but the heck, only if it touches it directly. But if you have meat that is holy meat that is became impure, or any meat that became impure, and it's wrapped in a garment, and that meat touches other food, it will pass over its impurity. What do we see from here? Impurity is easier to transmit than purity. Same way weeds grow more easily than vegetables. Right? Impurity is very easily transferred over. So, you know what, I have to move my car, I just realized. So the Das Mikra explains that that's a function of not allowing the Shomronim to build with you. If they build with you, their impurity will attach to you. Your purity won't attach to them. Okay?